Our final oral argument of this morning is Schaefer et al. Versus Haler et al. So as all parties approach the bench, we'll let you get settled. Getting settled, then this is case 822-1393, Schaefer et al. Versus Haler et al. As all parties are aware, the appellants will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief, respondents will have 15 minutes, and then finally the appellants will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Whenever you're ready, counsel for the appellants, just approach the microphone, tell us who you are in a loud, clear voice, and you may begin.
Good morning, Your Honors. Counsel, may it please the court. Bryant Cheetah and John Boyle from the Moss and Barnett firm for the appellants. With me in the courtroom today, I should point out, are Mr. Haler and Mr. Beskow. So I'll jump right into it. The issues have been fully briefed, but to my mind, there are three key issues that really control the outcome of this appeal. The first is that the district court erred by elevating principles of equity over the provisions of the Minnesota Uniform Partnership Act. That error of law turned the Uniform Partnership Act on its head. Second, the district court erred by concluding that the appellants are entitled to a fixed amount as their partnership return, irrespective of the partnership's actual profits or losses. That error of law effectively nullified the jury's verdict that these four farmers formed a partnership. Third, the district court treated the use of land and equipment as a contribution, while at the same time holding that title to that land and equipment did not pass to the partnership, and then allowed the respondents to keep all of that land and equipment for themselves, and then charging the partnership rent for the use of that land and equipment, even though there were and are no rental agreements entitling the respondents to collect rent. That error of law violated the Uniform Partnership Act's mandate that capital contributions become partnership assets. So I'd like to start with the first issue first, the Uniform Partnership Act versus equity. And this is a big legal question. The appellants argue that the Uniform Partnership Act is controlling in the hierarchy between the act and principles of equity. The respondents argue that, quote, only where equity directly contradicts the MUPA does equity not apply. That's at their brief at page 23. To my mind, Your Honors, the Uniform Partnership Act provides a pretty clear answer here. And it says, unless displaced by particular provisions of this chapter, the principles of law and equity supplement this chapter. That's in MnStat section 323A, point 104. A.
Go ahead, Judge Sleater.
Mr. Cheetah, I'm having a little hard time with the argument, and I saw it in your brief, and you just mentioned it here, that the court's decision effectively nulled the jury's decision. But and I'm not following that because the jury was only asked the one question, as I understand, was there a partnership? And
correct.
And answered yes. But when I look at 323A, 0103, to the extent the partnership agreement does not otherwise provide, this chapter applies. So doesn't that mean, let's assume there had been a specific written agreement, which was nowhere near what happened here, there's nothing but implied, that would have paid profits of $72,000 annually, I assume you would agree that would control.
I would not, Your Honor. And it's a great question. May I respond?
Yes, please.
Here's why. Even if it was in writing, if we said I'm getting $72,000 a year, irrespective of the actual profits of the partnership, that is not sharing of profits. Profits have to be tied to the actual profits of the enterprise. If all I'm getting is a fixed sum, nothing more, nothing less, no matter how the business does, that's not a partnership under Minnesota law. There has to be an entitlement to share profits.
But isn't that an agreement otherwise?
You can't have a partnership if that's the agreement. That's the problem, Your Honor. Does that make sense?
The first part, the last part, why can't you have a partnership if you agree to divvy up the proceeds, as that statute indicates, some way other than equally?
You can't agree some way other than equally. That I can see that in a skinny minute. We could agree to 60-40, 70-30, whatever allocation we want. What we can't say is that I get a specific sum that is not tied to the actual profits of the partnership because it's not sharing profits. And if you're not sharing profits, you're not a partner. There is no partnership under Minnesota law. And that's why the Duxbury case.
The district court had simply said you're entitled to $72,000 worth of profits over 6 years. Would that be enough?
No, because it's a sum certain. It's the Duxbury case that's cited in our brief. That case applies in spades. It was a joint part. That was a joint venture case, but for purposes of the, of you know, joint venture versus partnership, they're the functional equivalent under Minnesota law. And like a partnership in a joint venture, you can't have a joint venture without the element of an entitlement to share in the profits of the enterprise.
And I assume that also includes sharing in the losses.
It does, Your Honor. Yes.
So explain
although
to me.
Although, in a joint venture, I'll just clarify.
I'm talking about a problem. I'm talking about a partnership.
Correct.
Okay. So explain to me then why your clients were so reluctant when the respondents were saying, hey, perhaps you should share on the liability in the letter of credit, and your clients said no. That seemed to me what Steve Champlin at Dorsey and Whitney always used to call a bad fact for you.
That was
so. You know, doesn't that? I mean, the jury found there's a partnership, so there's a partnership, and it's up to the district court to sort out the terms. And your emphasis is, well, you know, we get a share in the profits, and the fixed return of $72,000 is, you know, verboten. But then the flip side is, if your clients were so interested in sharing the profits, why were they so reluctant in sharing the liability under the line of credit?
It's a fair question, Your Honor, and that was a challenging fact among a number of challenging facts at trial.
Which I'm not so sure you've overcome.
Your Honor, that's a distinction without difference, because when you have a partnership, guess what? If that creditor came in and wanted, and that loan went bad, and there was no security for the loan, and the Schaefers weren't able to satisfy the debt, guess who that creditor is going to be looking to? They're going to be looking to Paul and Kurt.
A judgment-proof debtor. You think the bank's going to go after that? I would think not.
Under law, Your Honor, they're equally liable for the partnership's debts.
Well, yes, obviously, but I'm talking about if you're right. They're equally liable. Now, in the real world, who's going to go? Who's the bank going to be looking to? Respondents or your clients?
They'll be looking to all four, and they'll collect wherever they can, Your Honor.
Right.
But
and they're going to collect from them, not you.
And that was a great argument that Mr. Gentleman made to the jury as to why no partnership was formed. The jury determined that there's a partnership.
They rejected it. I get that.
To come back and say now, well, yeah, because you didn't agree to it, I'm going to deviate from the terms of the Minnesota Uniform Partnership Act. And this, of course, is a partnership that's an implied partnership. Okay, nobody sat down and wrote an agreement. And shame on all four of them. But here we are. So
can I follow up on a couple of questions on
yes,
your nullification argument? First of all, the district court, I think it was finding 219, said your clients received benefits from the partnership beyond the $72,000 a year, and you didn't challenge the factual findings. So doesn't that say it's more than just this $72,000
The finding as to their partnership return, and it's in paragraph 10, I think on page 68, is that they're entitled as their partnership return to $72,000 a year, irrespective of the actual profits or losses of the partnership.
My second question goes to some of these cases that are cited in both parties' briefs dealing with this kind of fixed return, if I can call it that.
Yes, issue. Your Honor.
But it seems to me a number of those cases really came before, at least not all, but some of them, before the adoption of the Uniform Partnership Act, which, you know, as you know, when it says, hey, there's certain things a partnership agreement may not, it doesn't list what you just were saying to us.
It's in the right. Very definition of the partnership itself. It's the association of two or more persons for the purpose of profit. There has to be a profit component to it. And Duxbury is a more recent case, and that's exactly what that case holds is on the profit element. You can't have a partnership without profits, Your Honor. And there is a recent unpublished Minnesota Court of Appeals case that both parties have cited. And Mr. Gentilin appropriately argued that side of this to the district court before the finding of partnership on summary judgment, saying no profits equals no partnership. That's a fundamental, indelible principle of Minnesota law. You don't have a partnership if you're not having an entitlement to share in the profits of the enterprise. And I think that's abundantly clear both in the definition of partnership under the UPA and in the common law authorities that have been cited.
So is it, this just come down to what the label is for the $72,000? Is it a, you know, shared profit, or is it a fixed return on profits, or is it a salary? Is that really what this comes down to?
It doesn't, because what the district court held is you get $72,000 irrespective of whether the business lost money, made money, or otherwise. And yes, that's a salary. Or an independent contractor wage, that's not sharing of profits, that's not a partnership. That's the problem. And that's why, Your Honor, it's irreconcilable with the jury's finding.
What if the magic language was a guaranteed draw?
If it's a guaranteed draw, that is also not profits. We've cited Section 701 of the Internal Revenue Code in our reply brief, Your Honor. It deals with guaranteed payments. That's deductible as an ordinary expense, and it's paid as a wage. Again, that's not a sharing of profits, which would be treated differently. So, unless...
What did your clients do with their tax returns?
They reported the income as 1099 income. And again...
So they didn't file a partnership return?
They did not. Again, that was a challenging fact as to why there was a partnership or the partnership vel non question.
But I suppose that the argument is that's their problem with the IRS.
That would be, and on the issue of tax returns, there was a partnership return that encompassed all of the land and equipment and crops and everything that was used in this four-farmer partnership. It was filed as Bill and Patrick Schaefer partners, and Paul and Kurt aren't on it because we have an inadvertent partnership. But all of the assets that we're talking about, the land, the equipment, the crops, everything is included as a partnership asset as opposed to an individual asset. They had individual returns. And the district court made much ado of, well, Paul and Kurt didn't report this land and equipment and all of that on their individual tax returns or on their individual financial statements or on the financial statements of entities in which they had an ownership interest. Well, so what? Under 323A.0203, partnership property belongs to the partnership, not to the individual partners. That's where the assets were reported, and that's why we've said, you want the intent as to whether these were partnership assets or individual assets? Look to the federal asset report and where they place these assets. So if I may move on, I had two other issues to address, Your Honors, unless you had other questions on that point.
Go right ahead, Mr. Sheed.
Thank you. One final word on equity. So if the Uniform Partnership Act says something, the court has to do it, unless there's an agreement otherwise, but the problem here is the agreement he found would eviscerate the partnership. So that's that issue. I want to say a word about the Maris case on this point, and that does talk about equity and giving the district court some discretion in what to do, but that's in the context of the dissolution or accounting remedy, the final windup of the partnership. And I think what Maris is really talking about, and the best application of that is in the Schaefer versus Bork case, where the district court said, you know, so the one partner is entitled to several hundred thousand dollars in a payout, but if I do that immediately, it's going to kill the Christmas tree business. So I'm going to stagger those payments over time. That's what Maris is talking about with equitable discretion. I do not read Maris to say that on the grounds of equity, I can say, well, there were unequal contributions, so I'm going to deviate from the 50-50 split that's mandated by the Uniform Partnership Act. So what the district court did here was elevate equity over the Uniform Partnership Act when it concluded that given the wide disparity in contributions and financial commitment, a finding of equality in ownership, liability for losses, and rights to profits would be unfair. It's just saying, I don't think it's fair. I'm not going to follow the Uniform Partnership Act, and that's an error of law, Your Honor. Now, we've addressed the fixed return partnership issue. I think I've said what I have to say about that issue. I do want to say a word about contributions, because when a partner makes a contribution of an asset to a partnership, title actually passes from the partner to the partnership. So The district court here got it, just committed another error of law and said they contributed the use of land and equipment to the partnership, and this is a big number. The Schaefers are going to be at the district court saying, we're owed in excess of $10 million for rent, and said, because you contributed the use, no rental agreements, nobody's disputing that, you won't hear that come out of Mr. Gentleman's mouth this morning, because you contributed the use of those assets, there's no rental agreement, but you're entitled to a return on that contribution in the form of fair rental value. Huge error. You've either contributed the asset, in which case it's a partnership asset, and then the asset might, I contribute this pen to the partnership, it's worth a dollar. That's my capital contribution, title goes to the partnership. At dissolution, the pen is worth $2. I get my dollar back, the partnership gets the extra dollar on the appreciated value, it's split 50-50, each partner gets 50 cents as part of the partnership's profits. My red light is flashing.
I'll let you sum up.
So, in sum, there's not a single rental agreement here, and the district court just committed double error on this issue by, one, saying that because I let you use the asset, I'm treating that as a contribution where title didn't pass, and then doubling down on that and saying, even though there are no rental agreements entitling me to collect rent because I'm going to retain that asset, you now, partnership, have to pay me rent. Thank you, Your Honors.
And you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. We'll now hear from counsel for the respondents, please.
May it please the court, counsel. I am Corey Genlin with Gislason and Hunter. I'm here on behalf of the respondents, Pat and Sarah Schaefer, and Bill and Carol Schaefer. I'd like to make one very broad point before digging into the issues raised by the appellants. This case is about dissolution under Chapter 323A. That statute and the case law interpreting that statute are all about enforcing the agreement made between the parties, enforcing the partnership agreement. There's nothing in that statute, there's nothing in the case law interpreting that statute that empowers this process to change the relationship between the parties. And every issue that the appellants are raising, if they prevailed, would fundamentally change the relationship that they lived by for 8 years. The trial court found that there was an agreement for a fixed return. Appellants want that changed. The trial court found that the assets at issue were not partnership assets. So it's not a matter of treating them under the statute. They want that fact changed and those assets moved inside the partnership. As to issue three, the court found that the respondents did make contributions. That's a fact that has not been appealed. We can argue about whether or not use is a contribution, but as a matter of unappealed fact, there was a contribution. The statute says they get credit for that. And lastly, as to the debt, the appellants are asking to take debts that are personal debts and change that relationship and move them into the partnership. So I want to get to the fixed return of profits, and specifically I want to spend most of my time on this Schaefer versus Bork case, which has been briefed multiple times both on appeal and at the trial level.
Before you do that, just would you agree, at least on its face, it's a bit of a red flag when it's a fixed sum, because and especially here where nothing's in writing, and so it's undisputed that's what they're going to get regardless of profits. And so that's the point Mr. Cheetah made to me, that in and of itself is something other than profits, and if it's something other than profits, it's no partnership, and a jury already found a partnership, hence an error of law.
Your Honor, I would accept your statement if you changed it from red flag to unique. And the Uniform Partnership Act is built to have a great diversity of different business relationships so that business people can make these relationships and do business in any way they choose. You know, I'm reminded of a law firm that may have a partner who's got liver cancer and is going to go in for treatment and isn't going to be working for a long time. And the partnership meets and votes and decides, you know what, regardless of what we make next year, that guy's getting X number of dollars. They're not going to be contributing. We've got to deviate. Let's vote on that. Let's simply give them a fixed amount. Of course we can do that as attorneys. It happens all the time. So that's what this is about. And not only is if it is unique, if there's a red flag, that red flag, Your Honor, takes us directly to the case of Schaefer versus Bork. In Schaefer versus Bork, the partners had a partnership for 12 years, from 1970 to 1982. This was an oral agreement. The agreement was for the first 5 years, Mr. Schaefer gets a flat return of $8,200, regardless of the profits or losses of the partnership, and after that, he reverts to even Steven. That was the agreement. We know that Minnesota Court of Appeals case means that in those first 5 years, when the return was fixed, exactly like in this case, that was a partnership. We know that because one of the issues in front of the Court of Appeals was the statute of frauds. And the Court of Appeals said the statute of frauds doesn't apply because this partnership was terminable at will, meaning it could have been terminated in year three when the only return for Mr. Schaefer was an even $8,200, and even then it was a partnership. Now, I want to clear up some confusion that appellants brought up in their reply brief. I believe it's at page 10, where they say that the Schaefer case ended in an order for an equal division of profits. That is not the case. If you look at the Schaefer opinion at page 875, what it's saying is the jury, this is a quote, the jury also found that since 1975, so since that point when by agreement it transitioned from $8,200 to even Steven, there had been a disparity to Schaefer's detriment in the distribution of a partnership income. The jury found that disparity from 1975 to 1982, that disparity, there's an exact number in the opinion, but it's about $428,000. The jury awarded half of that. In other words, the jury and the Court of Appeals enforced the agreement, which is for 5 years you get $8,200, that's it. And after that, you get even Steven. They absolutely did not go back to those first 5 years and say, you get even Steven there as well. Your Honors, that is this case. Parties can do this. They can agree to a flat return. That is what Schaefer v. Bork says.
Mr. Gentleman, in the jury found there was a partnership, and it seems like there was some, well, the one thing I think I understand that most people agreed on was, well, we're going to have a partnership with no distributions until retirement. I mean, first of all, is that a fair statement? I mean, it seems to me that's both sides sort of, that was what I thought both sides were saying.
No, that is not what both sides are saying.
Okay.
Is that what
his side said?
That is what the appellant said.
What did your side say?
Our sides said that we didn't believe there was a partnership. And we learned something after trial one. We learned that there's this thing called an informal partnership. We learned that the way that works is you look at the behavior to figure out what the relationship is. And so our clients stuck with that decision, said, well, I guess that's what happens at trial two, is we look at the behavior to figure out what the relationship is. And we said to Judge Abrams, please look at 8 years of behavior and see what it was about. They got their $72,000 a year. There was a meeting in 2013 where Mr. Beskow brought a piece of paper, said, this is what I'm owed. It was money for the years in which he was paid $3,000 a month. There wasn't anything on there about additional profits. Yes, there was lots of testimony about, I thought $1 million was being held for me for retirement. There was also testimony of, did you track that? No. Did you ever talk about it? No. I thought the Schaefers were going to let me see their QuickBooks every year so that I could know where the money went. Did you ever ask to? No. Did you ever actually see them? No. For 8 years, you thought this was the deal? And so this gets back to this question of the idea that everybody denied there was an agreement to share profits. No, no, no. There was pretty over-the-top testimony, in fact, as to what that agreement was. There was a testimony, there was this testimony that was being held for retirement. So point being, everybody said there was an agreement. their version of agreement is not reflected in the findings.
Now,
does that answer your question, Your Honor?
Yes. And I apologize. I misread that. Now, in all fairness, the jury didn't find there was a limited partnership, did they? It found there was a partnership.
Correct.
So it seems to me your argument about the $72,000 sort of fixed return would be more applicable if the jury found there was a limited partnership, because, you know, because then it is a little different. Would that be a fair statement?
I don't agree, Your Honor.
Okay.
I think
why?
The,
why? Not.
It's no different than saying I own a corporation. There are certain things that we know about that simply by that statement. What does the corporation own? How many other shareholders are there? None of that is filled in. The jury verdict stands for the simple proposition there is a partnership. And by the way, remember that a partnership is a contract. You know, I hold in my hand a contract. Okay, well, what are its terms? That's what trial two was about. And essentially, appellant's position here is that trial two shouldn't have happened. We should have just had summary judgment because all the blank, because there's no blanks to fill in. MUPA just fills them in. That's why we had a trial, was specifically to find out what were the terms of the partnership agreement.
Right, and I don't envy the district court in its going through all of its findings of facts and finding what were partnership assets, what were not partnership assets. And at the end of the day, you know, the district court had to determine, since there was a partnership, what the terms were. But can the district court, you know, what is your best argument for rebutting Mr. Tsujita's argument that at the end of the day, you've got to have a sharing of profits? And the district court's opinion relating to that finding, the $72,000, seems to go against that. I mean, can the district court, and your argument is, well, you don't have to violate the Uniform Partnership Act because here's the agreement, so that supplements, you know, what's in the UPA. But what's your response? And I get that, and, you know, there is some merit to that, and I appreciate that. But, you know, that's that language the district court used, particularly with regardless of profit or loss, that does seem to be a little problematic. Now, why am I wrong?
Because per the testimony of the appellants and per the findings, that $72,000 was profits. And there's nothing in case law, there's nothing in the statute that says the share has to be a percentage. The case law says the opposite, that it can be a fixed amount. The $8,200 that Mr. Schaefer received in Schaefer v. Bork was profits. The $72,000 that these gentlemen received was profits. That's a matter of
You would
of
agree
findings.
With me that if it didn't have that extra language, regardless of profits of loss, you'd be in a stronger position. Because then it would be like, well, it's implied that was the profits that they were entitled to. Oh, you got to give me that.
Can I have the evening to think about it?
Sure. Well, even if you don't, that's where I find, that's problematic for me.
I guess to me, if I read a sentence that says they are entitled to $7,200, period, then it's implied that that is regardless of everything.
Okay. What are you going to do about the rental agreements?
So the fact is my clients, and when I say fact, I mean a finding. There is a finding that they made a contribution. Property interests can be divided up via time. They provided 8 years of the use of gigantic grain facilities, acres and acres of farm. A lease is a property interest. They provided, I mean, the right to use land is a property interest. It can be recorded. It can be exchanged. It is property. And by the way, at trial one, and I know this isn't bind, well, let me withdraw it. At trial one, the appellants needed to show that they made a contribution. This was their lead argument. They had Dr. Gorman, their expert, talk about the value of the use of these, of their grain facilities and their equipment. And this was from day one. One of the first facts developed, so what I'm getting at is that's their theory of this partnership, is that their contributions were things that they took back. They brought these leases. When the partnership broke up, they took those leases and went their way. Mr. Haler brought five pieces of equipment. When the partnership broke up, he left and he took his equipment with him. That was the deal. And just like everything else, other than a few exceptions, partners in Minnesota can agree on just about anything. And that's what they agreed to. So the fact is, and I want to make it clear, I also don't think there should be a double accounting. And I don't think that's what the order says. I think what the order says is just like any other contribution, they get credit to their capital account. And going forward, the measure of that is the rental value. They absolutely do not get a credit to their capital account and rent as much as I'd like to double my client's damages in any case. Real quickly, I don't think we disagree on equity. Equity can't go against the plain language of the statute. The problem is, one of the last things that counsel talked about was this line of credit. But we're stuck with the fact that as a matter of the law of the case, that wasn't a partnership line of credit. The law of the case is that wasn't partnership property. The tractors, the land, we're stuck with that. The last thing I want to talk about is if we simply have a new trial, is the district court going to be ordered to find facts that didn't happen? What exactly is that going to look like? I mean, the fact is there were these agreements.
I think the best the appellants can hope for is, particularly since they didn't challenge, well, since I didn't see anything saying which of these findings were clearly erroneous, it would simply be for a remand to correctly apply partnership law to the findings of fact. There would not be a new trial. I mean, I think that's a fair. Do you agree with that?
I do, and I'd go further and say that because on remand we'll be stuck with those same facts, what are we supposed to do with property that is outside the partnership that isn't going to change?
I agree.
So, I ask that the appeal be denied, that the trial court and the motion court be upheld. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Tsuchida, sir, you'll have the last word.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I mean, I am right. I mean, how can there be a new trial? It would just be, since the court, in your opinion, it is a matter of law, applying partnership law, it would be to go back to apply partnership law to these facts.
Your Honor, the motion for amended findings, unlike the motion for a new trial, is not appealable. So we are here appealing the denial of the motion for a new trial. The district court on remand, yes, I am asking the court to instruct the district court to properly apply Minnesota partnership law and the Uniform Partnership Act. Those should be the instructions. But if...
Well, I'm sure that'll be clear.
Correct. In a new trial...
God, I'm not on the district court anymore.
The court, since this part of the case was tried without a jury under Rule 59, the district court can do a number of things in the new trial. Under Rule 59, because this is tried without a jury, the court can take additional testimony. It can make amended findings of fact. It can make amended conclusions of law. It can make new findings and conclusions, and it can direct the entry of a new judgment. It can do any of those things, but that's not your problem. What I'm asking for is a reversal of the denial of the motion for a new trial and a remand with instructions to apply Minnesota partnership law and the terms of the Uniform Partnership Act, which is controlling here. Is that responsive to your question?
So then the district court then would presumably, with these facts, as to what's partnership assets and what's not, take another shot at determining whether there were profits, and if so, you know, that they're to be divided 50-50.
I want the court to apply the provisions of the Uniform Partnership Act, which apply in the absence of an agreement to the contrary. The problem here is the district court found an agreement that does not constitute a partnership. And the jury was absolutely instructed. You can go look at the jury instructions in this case. You can't have a partnership here if there is no entitlement to share profits. Well, that's partnership law 101. On the issue of the contribution, it's not a factual question. Use is not a contribution. That is a legal issue. And title passing, when there is a contribution to the partnership, is not a factual issue. That's a legal error. Those legal errors I'm asking the court to reverse.
You know, Mr. Chia, you keep saying use is not a contribution. I mean, and perhaps I'm wrong. The facts are overwhelming. I mean, Besco didn't own the land, right? That he was contributing.
We're not arguing that that's a contribution.
Okay.
That's not part of our dissolution analysis. We're not asking for nickel of credit for any asset.
I'm right, though. He didn't own the land that he was contributing. Would that be a fair statement?
Kurt and Paul controlled leases for land. Yes.
So the answer is yes.
So yes, they did not contribute it. They didn't own it.
Right, okay.
And by the way, the Schaefers didn't own most of their land either. So land was bought throughout the course of this partnership. Equipment was bought to the tune of, I think, $2.5 million roughly worth of land, and equipment with worth about $1.5 million. This whole fiction about Cedar Ridge Enterprises, that's a DBA.
Equipment was bought. This was bought through the line of credit of the Schaefer's line of credit.
No,
separately than that.
The only source of revenue, and yes, there was credit, is the farm. Crops are planted, they're grown, they're harvested. Those are the revenues. If the line of credit is used, guess what services that debt? Crop proceeds. It's the only source. That's it. It's four guys, 10,000 acres, and a farm. That's what this is. And we can play a semantics game to say, but Pat and Bill used the name Cedar Ridge Enterprises before this four-person partnership was formed. They used Cedar Ridge Enterprises throughout the course of this partnership. That's what they called this farm. So, Your Honor, I am here arguing legal issues. Those are what I'm asking to be reversed. The district court has can do a lot of things on a motion for a new trial. But we've got to fix these fundamental legal errors so we can apply the law properly. And what it effectively did was relegate Paul and Kurt to employees, but it's even worse, because not only are their employees getting $72,000 a year, you look at the analysis in our reply brief of what the Schaefer are going to argue on the final dissolution. Not only that, for the privilege of working with us for nearly a decade, you owe us $9 million. That's the outcome they're advocating for. So I'm asking that respectfully that the court reverse the legal errors. My light is blinking. Can I just sum up less than 10 seconds?
Sure.
Reverse the legal errors that we've identified, order a new trial, and remand with instructions to properly apply Minnesota partnership law, and in particular the Minnesota Uniform Partnership Act. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The matter was well argued, well briefed. We will be issuing our decision within 90 days. That being our last oral argument of the day, we are adjourned.
Please rise.